It is an important moment for business leaders heavily invested in retail. And beyond temporary restrictions and waiting for a rise in footfall around the world, it's a moment where retailers are rethinking not only their offerings to be sure to attract in-store shopping, but also thinking hard about their own long-term footprint. Among them, one of the most exciting brands in recent years here in Europe, Ace & Tate. Mark DeLange came up with the idea for the disruptive company in 2011 after a trip to New York City, knowing there would be a huge appetite for doing things differently in the eyewear market. While a number of brands went all in on direct-to-consumer, Ace & Tate has made a huge impact with its in-store offering. And Mark says he doesn't really mind where customers make their purchase, as long as their journey to getting that new pair of glasses is a positive one. All retailers now know the value of having a seamless online shopping experience. But how many are also busy reworking their bricks-and-mortar plan? From modest beginnings of doing free eye tests in their office, the company has had massive success. Since we last heard from Mark on this show, in our theme about mentors 2 summers ago, Ace & Tate has doubled its retail outposts in Europe to 65. Recently, they received another round of funding to push that number to 70 this year. While plans may have been slowed by lockdowns, Mark is optimistic about the coming months and years. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. This week, also on the theme of connecting with brands in person, later in the show we'll meet a former lawyer turned ceramics designer. Stina DeLong is the founder of London-based Scandihus. We'll meet her coming up. But first, we're off to Amsterdam. I thought it was an important time to check in with Mark DeLange to discuss Ace & Tate's plans to continue growing their retail business across Europe, and how, interestingly, that meshes with the brand's take on sustainability. And Mark's got some great advice as well for small business owners unsure of how and when to get into retail. Here's Mark now with the story of Ace & Tate.
So I was on a trip to New York with my then girlfriend and now today wife, Eva. And this was late 2011. We stayed at this hotel in Soho, and every day we would pass this store that sold beautiful eyewear, but it was super expensive. On the last day, we're literally going to the hotel to pick up the bags and go to the airport. There was a sales sign out at the store. I wandered in, quickly bought a pair of frames, went back to the Netherlands, and then I had to put in the lenses. And to put in the lenses at my prescription was expensive. It was very unclear why I paid a lot of money, as I have a very low prescription, and it took a lot of time. And once I got the frame back with the lenses, my prescription, I looked at it and I thought, this is, well, happy to have the frame, but it didn't feel like a particularly complex or super innovative product that warranted the complexity of the process. That made me think, could this be easier, more fun, maybe a better value proposition to the customer? And the second insight was, I would have 25, 30 pairs of sneakers in my closet, and I had one pair of glasses. And it's actually super strange because you tend to switch up your outfit when you are in different occasions, maybe going to the bank for a loan or in a serious business situation, you would switch everything up relative to going to the club or to dinner with friends, but the frame would stay the same. And I think all that combined became Ace & Tate.
That's quite interesting. As you say, glasses really do represent a lot of your personality, I think, for people that wear them regularly. Obviously, people have been buying eyewear and having, you know, specific eyewear made for them for quite a long time. So it's interesting to try to come in and do something a little bit different. What was your vision of that? Just sort of the customer journey or where did you think you could really make a change?
It was about a couple of things. One, I thought the journey could be far easier. It could be more fun, more like buying that new sweater or the pair of jeans that you really liked. And that was very much in tone of voice and the way you'd be approached in the store or online. And also there's a price element to it. I think in optical retail, specifically at that point in time, it was very normal to come in with the offer of getting 3 frames for the price of 1. And you would walk out with 1 pair for the price of 3 because you need an extra coating because of your special eyes or only that 1 little frame was on sale for the price they had advertised with. And we came into the market with a flat price structure, €98, £98, including everything.
You know, it's interesting, in and around the time you guys got started, a lot of companies might have thought about just going for the direct-to-consumer model. Obviously, retail, a vital part of your operation. Now you obviously do online sales as well. You're up to 65 stores. So talk to me about how that became a part of the important concept for you.
So a physical part in the customer journey had always been a part of the plan because of the nature of this specific product. It's a high-touch product. I think a lot of the consumers still like to talk to a human, specifically when buying their first pair of eyewear, prescription eyewear particularly. So we experimented with a couple of different versions of that, a traveling optician, pop-up stores in different shapes and sizes, shops. When we went to our second office, I think, so we upgraded our office, we were there like 15 people, and a little extra room became available. And we decided to hire an optician and to do eye tests basically in our office. And on Saturdays, we'd just be packed, just rammed. At that point, I got offered a space in the 9th Street, which is like a beautiful shopping area in Amsterdam. And we just decided to take the plunge. So we just decided to do it. That's been so successful that we never look back.
You know, you said to me off air that the importance of the customer journey is really the key for you. And that can be both in physical retail locations and in engaging with the brand online and that way, however you want to order, however you want to find information. But I'm just curious about how that has sort of changed, how you've rethought that in the past couple of months. Obviously, you said you've slowed down your planned pace of growth, but has that made you change strategy at all, change tact and think about in the long term, you know, where physical retail isn't always an option, how that might change things for the company?
Well, as you mentioned, for us, it's always been about that. I think the buzzword right now is unified commerce experience. So we try to offer the customer an online or digital and a physical touch point for every link in the customer journey, from orientation to purchase and after sale. So that has not changed. But I think when looking at the ratio between physical and digital channels, the speed of adoption of digital retail has picked up. So we've seen our online channels grow, and we've seen the physical channels, due to closing them down, decline a bit. So I think it has only strengthened our thesis that that combination of the two channels will become fully integrated, with maybe slightly more emphasis on the digital part of that.
I'm curious just about another buzzword. You mentioned one. The other one, obviously, is impact and responsibility, sustainability, perhaps. I know that's part of your mission. Have you been thinking about those conversations and how you engage there?
I think the beauty of it right now is that people are traveling less, so that's a win for the planet. But we've been thinking a lot for the past year or so what we can do to make our physical store experience less harmful to the planet. So it's something we've been investing quite a lot of time and resources in. And what that means for us is, in the past, when we'd find a building that we loved, we would look at that as a blank slate, and then we'd go to work. Now we are looking more at how can we keep as much of the building as is, so not to do too much construction, which really has a lot of impact on the environment, and to work with what we have. We are looking into making our furniture as modular as possible and to make it something we can construct and deconstruct or take with us when we leave the building and use it again, and to use as many standardized materials that are available in the marketplace already, because everything you make custom, again, renders a lot of waste. It's been a long time coming. I think this pause basically gave us the time to really think about that and to really hash that out.
I'm just thinking about moving forward as well for the company. You mentioned the sort of slowing of growth, but obviously that won't change your ambition at all. So what's the energy like at the company now, and how do you sort of keep that focused moving forward? Obviously, there still is some unknown about restrictions specifically for physical locations, but how do you sort of keep that energy and motivation going?
I guess our mission has not changed. We still want to become the eyewear brand for Gen Y and Gen Z, if you will. First in Europe, and who knows, maybe then world domination at some point. And that hasn't changed. Also, the aspect of that of being less harmful to the environment and becoming a leader in the optical industry, that hasn't changed either. And I think a lot of people at the company are actually energized, because our pace of growth has been so mental over the past couple of years. This has provided us with a pause and to look inwards, to reflect on what we've done over the past couple of years, and also to evaluate what we could have done better or what we will do better in the future. And that, for instance, applies to the way we think about store fit out.
Just on a personal note, obviously this must be a stressful time, but how do you manage that and how has that impacted your well-being, let's say?
I must be honest, it has frustrated me greatly. I think at first I was in solution mode, so I wasn't too bothered, I didn't have time to really be frustrated about what was happening to the company. I just to solve the immediate issue. Looking at what is happening now, maybe a second version of a lockdown. I wouldn't say I'm too happy about the business at the moment, but I firmly believe in the Stoics that you shouldn't be too worried about what you can influence. So I'm trying to focus on what I can influence. Also, I became a father 8 months ago, so that's something that keeps me very sane and something very different from the business. So that really helps.
Yes, can keep you grounded, I imagine. And other business founders will understand that feeling as well. That's interesting that, you know, when you're sort of backed in a corner and can think of what you can do to manage those things, because there's so much that is out of your control. And even more so now, it's sounding looking at the news today, we don't know what's coming, as has been the case in the last few weeks. That must also be encouraging that you can continue to sort of problem solve and lead in that sense.
Definitely. I think I had to learn in the past months more than ever before to become a leader to the company. And not just a dude with an idea that got lucky. I had to really think about what the people inside Ace and Tate needed during this phase. And luckily, I had some people around me helping with this. And I think we've been fairly successful to lead the team through this, well, not easy phase. And I think just to get back to the Stoics, that's one of the things that has really, really helped me, just to focus on the things you can influence and just try to forget about the other stuff. And that is something that, for me as an entrepreneur, is super valuable advice.
Yeah, I wonder on the advice side, if you might have anything to share for, let's say, a smaller company founder or, you know, someone that's looking to go to the next stage, thinking about what our brand is. Do we go into retail? You know, someone trying to get off the ground and sort of really having a hard time with everything that's happening and all of these things that aren't in their control. What might be your advice for sort of managing what you can control?
Well, if someone is thinking about opening a store, then I'd probably say for the next 6 months, don't, if it's your first store. Also, because I think the rental environment will become more interesting as time progresses. But no, in all seriousness, I would think, obviously, and that's the obvious answer, about the interplay between an online store, a digital channel, and your physical channel. More important than ever is, like, let's say modern luxury is these days. I think it's more than ever about a bigger world than just the product. It's about your complete value proposition. So it's the full experience. It's a great product, a super strong delivery and returns mechanism. It's about clear language, great branding. I think that is something that the DTC brands, the direct-to-consumer brands, have championed. And it's I think, a way more attractive proposition vis-a-vis traditional luxury retail. So I think that one through very carefully.
Do you think, though, with some of those DTC brands, the sort of the end game, that customer journey, the full experience gets lost? Obviously, you know, slick marketing is easy to do and easy to get stuff out there, but it's tough to get that whole picture right.
Definitely. And obviously, there are good examples and lesser examples of that. But I think what being a direct consumer brand enables a company to do is to own that full experience. You can own the experience from designing the product to offering that product through one of your channels to facilitating the purchase and the after sale. And that's something when obviously you do wholesale, you cannot. It's your responsibility as a brand to make sure that every link in that chain works well and works to the advantage of the customer. And I think ultimately those are the brands and businesses that will survive in the long term.
Just lastly, of course, I'd be remiss to not ask you about product and design, a very important part of what you do, Mark. We've touched on the importance of sustainability and things like that, but talk to me just a little bit about how you're planning the next steps of your design and your product, continuing to be able to deliver top of the line stuff while also focusing on that retail journey. How do you sort of think on where the product goes from here?
Well, we are... and this might sound strange, but we are less focused these days on making the coolest eyewear. We are focused on making stylish, great eyewear. And what we mean by that is fashion versus style. Fashion is out after maybe two seasons and you discard of the product, which is an unsustainable proposition. And we try to focus on things that are for the long term. My eyes being opened to the need for a more sustainable future had its impact on our design philosophy. And another thing, so we spent all this time on how can we be more responsible in delivering and creating our product. And after 3 years thinking about this and trying everything we could, the most sustainable thing we can do is not to create a new product. So something we just launched was Reframe. And Reframe is an initiative where we will be reselling our own products. So we invite our customers to bring back their Ace and Tate eyewear. They get store credit in return. We refurbish the product and then resell it at a different price point to the end consumer. So I think we're doing different things to close that loop and to be as mindful as possible of the waste we create as a brand.
Very well said, Mark. I appreciate your frank talk and your candor. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
That was Mark DeLange, the founder of Ace and Tate. My thanks to Mark. You can also hear him on episode 359 of this show, our feature on mentors. You can learn more about the brand at aceandtate.com. Next up on this week's program, we meet Stina DeLong, the founder of ceramics brand Scandihoose. Back in 2014, Stina left her job as a lawyer to focus full-time on pottery. After first putting her hands on clay at an evening class the year before, Stina says she felt as if she'd arrived at home. Today, she has two studios in London, where her team of almost 20 people put on classes for the more than 250 people that pass through their doors each week. And her own pieces are in high demand. She's created tableware for the likes of Nigella Lawson and Yotam Ottolenghi, and her pieces are also used by a host of high-end restaurants, including the Hand in Flowers, the Connaught Hotel, and Nobu. At the start of this month, classes resumed after a few months of being on hold because of the lockdown. I spoke to Stina as she was preparing to reopen the doors to students, and we discussed the future of her brand and her inspiring story of turning a passion into a successful business.
Whilst I was still working as a lawyer, I signed up for lots of evening classes. I've always been quite creative, and I guess in a way I was looking for an outlet, that something that wasn't work and something where I could be creative. And one of these many evening classes I signed up for was ceramics. And the first pottery class I went to, when I touched the clay, it was like I had arrived home, or like this was just, it was like a sense of familiarity that I've never really experienced before. And the teacher, funnily enough, she noticed and said to her colleague, we've got another victim. And it's interesting because I see that in students now, once in a while it happens in classes. I was already quite unhappy in my job, and I was already sort of going through life just feeling like I was wearing the wrong outfit. But it was like I couldn't really articulate what it was, because outwardly I was having all the things that we are being told from an early age that success is. You know, it's like I had a really well-paid job, and it was like a prestigious job as a lawyer, and I had all the things, and yet inside it just felt so wrong, and I felt so actually quite sad. And then I think when I was making, when I was in my ceramics classes, this magic thing happened that I was able to stay present in the moment, and I was able to stay with what I was doing. And I think suddenly for the first time in my life, it wasn't about being good at it, and it wasn't about achieving or striving or, you know, moving on to the next sort of level, which I think very much so a lot of us end up living that way in a capitalist world where it's sort of, it never ends. It's like an eternal upward sort of spiral of achievement. And I was exhausted also. And I think in my pottery classes, I could rest. It was like my whole being was like resting into the clay.
That's absolutely fascinating. I love the idea of you feeling sort of at home in your class, and feeling like it was a good direction for you personally. Talk to me a little bit about how that becomes a business. You're going to classes, but I mean, leaving a job, as you say, and one that is well paid is never an easy thing. So talk to me about how that journey continued.
I was still working for a while as a lawyer whilst doing evening classes. And then one evening class a week turned into two evening classes a week. And I actually remember, I probably shouldn't say this, but I remember sitting in a meeting in a skyscraper in New York with FBI agents interviewing our client. And it was very sort of high profile. And I caught myself looking at the shape of the glasses thinking, oh, this would look so nice as a ceramic cup. And, you know, I think once you're there, you're in the wrong job. It sort of became almost an obsession. It was all I could think about. I'd wake up in the middle of the night with things I wanted to design. So I quit my job to give myself a break for a year. And I'd saved up enough money that I didn't have to work for a year. So I wasn't actually intending to quit my job to become a potter, because not in my wildest dreams did I think I could make a living from it. But then I was lucky that this open access ceramic studio had just opened a month before I quit my job. So I joined there as a member, and it works a bit like a gym. So you get 15 hours a week where you can come and go as you please, and then you can make your ceramics. And then they, 6 months later, had a sort of a market, like a studio sale. And I thought, I'll try and see if anybody wants to buy my work. And honestly, within half an hour, I had sold out. That was it. I just had nothing more to sell. And that was the moment where I thought, wow, maybe I can actually make a living from this. And then I founded Scandihoops very shortly after. And yeah, it's sort of just been very fast, actually, ever since then.
So talk to me a little bit about the business. We should point out that you are from Denmark, and this is a little bit of the design is sort of looking back to your homeland, and that's a big part of it, I know. But you're designing things, but you're running classes. It's not necessarily you were setting out to create a line of cookware or pottery or something like that. You actually wanted to continue on and do classes like you had been part of. So talk to me about that and how you sort of made a business model out of it.
Yeah, so I think it was sort of twofold. So one was I loved making my own work, but I also really loved passing on that joy that I'd found in ceramics myself. So when I founded Scandihoops and got my first studio, I very quickly sort of started running classes. This is actually how I funded it. So I founded the whole studio with only £6,000, the whole business. And I just pre-sold classes. So it was almost like crowdfunding. So the day that I signed the lease, I put the first classes online, and then classes started 2 weeks later. And I already had a big following of students that had said to me, where I was teaching another studio, they'd already said, wherever you go, we're coming with you. So I suppose in that way, it wasn't as big a risk as it sounds. I also was making and producing my own work, and I had already had some quite well-known chefs pick up my work and start, and they had started using it. And the business is still twofold, and I think it always will be. I hope it always will be. Because what I realized actually when I started teaching was that I got just as much joy from that and seeing the sort of healing powers of ceramics on all the students as well. And, you know, they come into the studio with all their stress from London and they were floating out of the door, you know, 2.5 hours later. And that's quite special, being able to give that to people around you.
Well, you mentioned some of the quite prominent people that have picked up your work. Obviously, there's Nobu and Otto Lange and Nigella Lawson, I think, is another one. So that's interesting. I'm just so curious about why you sort of continued on with that sort of twofold business model, where your work, or the classes rather, could help fund your work and your progression as an artist as well. Because obviously, there must have been some thought on, does this just become my own work and my own creations that sort of becomes the business?
I think that question is a really good one. And it goes back to the whole reason I quit my lawyer job and what success ended up meaning for me. Because beforehand, success had always been this outward thing. And suddenly success actually just became more about learning to live with myself. And that involved, you know, not being so stressed and distracted by work all the time. And it involved, actually, also as part of my journey, I stopped drinking alcohol. And there's been lots and lots of changes that have over the years slowly crept in. In essence, I suppose, is what we call self-care. And success to me suddenly looked more like that. It looked more like, how do I treat people around me? Do I have time for my friends and family? Do I have time for a forest walk in the morning before I go to the studio? And the answer to that is yes, because I've set the working hours so that I have time to go to this forest every morning. And things like that to me suddenly became success, and not all these outward things that we are told success is.
This may be a bit of a stretch, but you have been in the UK for quite a long time now, a number of years. But thinking back to your upbringing, we always hear, of course, about the quality of life in Scandinavia and the Nordic nations, and you know, those things being outdoor and connected to your homeland, I know are super important. I'm just curious if it was sort of a rediscovery of that you've now been able to bring to this work in London, which is just part of perhaps your natural journey as a person and as a professional.
That's a good question. I've never really thought of that, but I think you may be right. And I think that part of the whole popularity in recent years of, you know, Danish hygge and the sort of the Danish way of living has been a lot about mindfulness and slowing down and appreciating the small things and creating coziness at home. So yes, you're probably right that this is in a way me returning to my roots, both through the clay, but maybe also through a way of life.
Now, in normal times, obviously, you have the studio open throughout the week, and there are hundreds of people that come through your doors, and perhaps some of them are becoming hooked like you were a number of years ago. You also continue to sell and show your own work, but talk to me a little bit about that setup. I mean, you're up to almost 20 employees, I think. Obviously, in recent months, that's been more difficult and not been possible to run your courses, but talk to me about the actual offerings that you do have in the studio.
Yeah, so we run taster sessions, which is for individuals that want to come and try their hands on clay. And then we run 6 and 12 week courses for those that get hooked, basically. And then I also, the other side of the business again, is the production of my own work, where I have studio assistants that help me with, you know, the preparation of the clay and the mixing of the glazes. And there's lots of all the work behind the scenes, but I'm still involved with every single piece that gets produced in one way or another. And that's really important to me that it remains that way. And then on the other side of the business, we have about 270 students, or pre-COVID, we had 270 students through the doors at the two studios every week. So that's quite a large number.
Just lastly, I would love to hear about sort of what is in the works for now. Obviously, beyond reopening and getting everyone back to the studio, which is super exciting for you, what do the next months look like? Do you get back on a regular sort of business plan like you had before? What might we see in the pipeline ahead for you?
Well, so the studio is a reopening, and we are running at a slightly reduced number in classes to make it safe. And we've put up screens and we've made it all COVID safe. So it's going to be quite a different teaching experience, but we will see. And then the other side of what's happening is that I've actually just ended up getting a book deal. So I'm also going to be writing a book about my journey. And that almost feels like, you know, someone out there is looking after me, because I've had all this time to think about and, you know, start writing and working on that.
That's absolutely fascinating. I lied. I did have one last question, and that's just about setting out on your own. Obviously, the big leap to quit your job and start something on your own must be quite daunting. Some people might never find that courage, let us say. I'm curious what you think that takes, and perhaps some advice just for other people that are sort of thinking, you know, that doing something they actually like might be more rewarding, and there are other sort of definitions of success. What might be your advice? Because obviously there's a lot of uncertainty. There has been probably sleepless nights for you and a lot of hard work. So what might you advise?
I always find this question a little bit hard, because I think that telling people that there's this one thing out there that is the right thing for them, but they just have to find it, that's not very helpful, because you're setting people up for failure. I think instead, actually, what my journey has been about is it's been more about appreciating the things that I already have. And then it's been about saying no to the things that didn't feel right. And automatically, when you start saying no to what doesn't feel right, like for me, being a lawyer didn't feel right, so I started saying no to doing that, then you actually start saying yes to the things that do feel right, because you make room for them. And that's an approach that I have taken in life more generally as well. And with people I make time for, you know, by saying no, it's like in the beginning, I thought I had to say yes to every commission that came my direction. But actually, that's just not a very smart idea, because then you can't fully commit to anything. And then you end up not being present with anything you're doing, and you're spreading yourself thin. And then when I started saying no, then the things I did say yes to, I could 100% fully throw myself into it. And then you come with presence, and they're all of you. And having all of you with what you do in life is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
I think that's great advice in itself, certainly. Stina, your journey is absolutely fascinating, and I very much appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Stina DeLong, the founder of Scandihus here in London. You can find out more at skandihus.co.uk. And that's it for this week's program. My thanks to Jack Jewers, who mixed and edited this program. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.